by certain codes, codes that come down to us from our family, codes that come down to us from our community, from our religion, from any number of places. And we choose to either abide by those codes or to reject those codes. But what we often find is that we cannot do either one absolutely. And what I have found is that the codes of my father, the Stoic codes of grace under pressure, if you will, in the Hemingway sense, are the codes that have most surely shaped me. They scarred me as well and paralyzed me, but they were also the codes that allowed me to survive. To survive even my father. As Jeff mentioned, we talked about how do you create a narrative of meaning? How do you take a part of your life and try to write it into art, into nonfiction, into literary nonfiction? How do you take a dysfunctional part of your life, trauma in your life, and create a functional narrative of meaning out of that dysfunction? How do you make it make sense? How do you make that leap into art? How do you transcend the truth of your own life, even as you bear witness to that truth? So I'm going to read a section today that I hope does those things. It's from Hunger for the World, my second memoir. I need to just give you some quick background information that takes place in my first memoir, In the Wilderness. I was raised in the very isolated logging camps and little towns of north central Idaho. My father was a logger. We became involved in a fundamentalist church, a very particular form of Pentecostal fundamentalism called Pilgrim Holiness. It's almost, the women almost look as though they belong, say, to the Amish or Mennonite groups. The women are not allowed to cut their hair. We couldn't wear jewelry or makeup because we draw attention to ourselves. We couldn't wear pants, anything like that. We were the daughters of Eve, and therefore we must remain silent and invisible. And this is the religion I came to an awareness of myself in as a young woman, and it defined my life and the lives of the women around me. When I was about 12, my father had a crisis of faith and believed that he heard the voice of God telling him that we must leave the wilderness he loved and never come back. And we did. In 24 hours, we were gone. We loaded up everything we could in the Chevy, and we moved to Lewiston, Idaho, a couple hours, basically, southwest. It was in Lewiston that I rebelled against my father in the church. In eighth grade, I ran away from home, was found, and dragged back. I came back into the church at that point, shamed by my disobedience. But the night of high school graduation, I had a final falling out with my father when he told me I couldn't do something, and I said, "What if I do it anyway?" And he said, "Then you take your things and you never come back." And I did. And I never went back into the church. It was as though in breaking with my father, I had broken with my heavenly father, and in a way I had. This book that I'm going to read from details what happens in those couple of years after leaving my home, leaving my faith, leaving every community I had ever known. My father shunned me, and it was very ritualized shunning. I became invisible to him. He would not speak my name. He would not sit down at the dinner table with me. I was invisible to him for my disobedience. What happened was that at the age of 19, I met a man who was much older than I was. And he was a long-haul truck driver. My father was a truck driver at this point. I came to understand that he represented what I thought was an escape from the life I had been leading. He went about methodical seduction, roses, yellow Corvette, steak and lobster. I loved it. What I didn't understand was that he was a sexual predator. We didn't even have that term then. And that the next year of my life would be a year that I would be lucky to survive. His name's David. When the section I'm reading from takes place in Lewiston, Idaho, it's about 1978. I'm about 20 years old. What David wanted from me was absolute submission. And it's an irony I will live with for the rest of my life, that the very thing I had stepped away from with my father was what I found myself more deeply mired in. And I understand now that David was a perverse extension of my father's dominance in my life. And finally, what he wanted from me was submission at every level, including sexual submission, and he wanted to prostitute me. So, at the point that I'm going to read, he's been taking me to Seattle on his truck hauls and trying to teach me what I need to know. I'm going, learning from the women he frequents in Seattle. And we have come to a point, as I did with my father, where I can no longer be under his submission. Let me start with just a short passage from the end of the book. I think of the Inuit way, a wolf bone whittled to a point at both ends, coiled and frozen in blubber, left along the path of bears. The bear eats it and weakens slowly, over miles, over days, the bone twisting and slashing, killing from the inside out. Shame feels this way, swallowed and sharp, working its way deeper with each move to dislodge the pain, so that finally we lie still, dying with blood in our mouths. We eat our stories and starve. My life, it seemed, was falling away from me in great clumps. I had alienated my friends and family. When, after minor surgery on my knee, I didn't check in with my supervisor at the drive-in, he replaced me with someone less likely to miss her scheduled work days. Suddenly, I had no money to buy food or gas, no money to make the payments on my car. I felt peeled, raw, and wounded, relieved when David offered to cover my share of the rent and groceries until I could find another job. "You can owe me," he said, 50%. I agreed, though I knew my salary would never match his and wondered how he thought I might pay. Those pieces of my life that had remained outside David's influence were now more tightly bundled. It was no longer my apartment, but his. Not my black and white atop the chest, but his color TV. My bed had been knocked apart and put into storage. His, he said, was more comfortable. His dishes in the cupboards, his guns in the rack, the great horned owl he had killed and had stuffed mounted above the mantel. Who of us then was most desperate? For just as surely as David had built his prison around me, he immured himself to my keep. There was this fetter between us, this chain of servitude and responsibility. I cooked for him, cleaned and laundered. I counted the days of his halls across Washington. I curled my hair, put on lipstick, dressed in the outfits he favored, sat on the couch and awaited his return. None of it seemed to matter. Even our once lively conversation had become stilted, as though we had emptied ourselves into each other and now must face the limits of our kin. Our hours together were spent watching TV. At some point during the evening, he would shower, put on the clothes I folded, and then he would leave. Whenever I questioned David about his life away from me, he reacted with anger. He must have felt my pulling away, not from him, but from the life he had planned for me. The terms had always been clear. If I wanted him to stay, I would keep my mouth shut, do as he said. If David's frustration drove him to sullenness, I responded with exaggerated regard, stroking, pacifying, just as I had seen my mother mollify, take heed. But even the offering of my body was no longer enough to move David. He tensed away from me in bed and would not speak, so that I lay in the dark, cut off from the sound of him, the feel of him, and because my existence had become dependent on his acknowledgement and approval, it was as though I were no longer visible. I was the air around him, the sheet's caress, the light falling in through the window. I felt my resolve weaken, the fear of rejection rise. I remember the panic of it still, David's turn away from me, the shunning. Although I now understand his intention to bring me to yet another level of subjugation, to destroy whatever scrap of self-will I still possess. In desperation, I begged David to tell me what I could do to make him see me again. It was true, there had been things he wanted from me I would not give, had thought I could not give, but now I said yes, that there was nothing I would not do or give or let be done to me. I would obey. I was that kneeling girl offering my life, my soul, every part of me to win salvation, to regain my patriarch's good grace. I had learned my lesson. Please do not cast me out. David brought his eyes back to me then. His demands were not of the coarse nature that I had thought they would be. He asked only this, that I trust him completely. I must be patient and prove that I trusted him by my continued silent presence, even though he would not say my name or even look at me. I cried and swore I would do these things. I huddled against him in the darkness of our bed, felt the thinness of his back and legs, the rigid curve of his spine. I closed my eyes so that I could not see his face turned away from me. I folded my hands between my knees so they would not be wanton, would not implore. The next morning, he said that this is how it would be, that I must not question, never ask where he was going or when he would return, but must remain constant and wait. I lowered my eyes, bowed my head. When the door had closed after him, I lay back down on the bed, believing myself unable to rise, to walk, or even eat. In the empty room, in the tattered gray light of pre-dawn, I thought of my mother and her worn robe beginning to make the coffee, fry the eggs, my father whom she would awaken and feed, whose clothes she would have pressed and laid out so that he had only to slip them on to be dressed and ready, my brother still dreaming whatever dreams a good boy is given, the crack of bat against ball, the car he might someday own, the girl whose blonde hair fills his fingers. Unreachable now, those people. I could never ask them to take me back, to accept me once again as their own. I had burned that bridge, and the gulf that stretched behind me could never be crossed. Did I believe that I deserved this final subservience, dues owed for the years I had fought to control my own existence? Punishment, after all, was my familiar, my most expected return. I look back and see how the rhythms of my life have followed this pattern: rebellion, punishment, submission, and then the cycle repeating. I would strike out, expecting the reprisal, perhaps even bringing it on. Always, I had understood the gravity of my actions, and always, I knew what my actions would bring. The belt across my bottom, the switch across my legs, the open hand, eventually the groundings and loss of my already limited freedom, the threat of eternity in hell. But the discipline and the warnings I had heard all my life had not had their desired effect. I seemed never human. Could it have been then that even as David punished me, drove me toward what he believed might be my point of breaking, I was preparing myself for battle, protecting that part of myself that yet remained outside his control, some fragment I had thrown to the sky, where it floated above me, quiet and invisible. Closed in behind locked doors and shaded windows, I drifted, aware only of the moments when I woke, then wished myself back into sleep. There were sounds outside that filtered into me, traffic, the high laughter of children walking home from school, but the sounds were dreams, and I liked them that way, let them weave into the deafness of my slumber. Escape, denial, depression, all of these, of course, but something else. I was resting, gathering my strength. When the loop of outside noise began to repeat itself, became something familiar, I realized I had slept through the beginnings and endings of several days. I rolled to my side, let my eyes focus on the simple shapes, the complex shadows of the dresser, the closet, the floor. There was nothing in that room that might hurt me, nothing except the blade of my own shame, my weakness, and despair. Instead of dread, what I felt was a calm that I had never expected. Released from its constant vigil to defend, my mind had emptied itself, and what came back into me was a clarity so intense I could taste it, see its colors, icy and blue and deeply translucent, like the water come off the high mountains. As a child, I had mimicked my father as he knelt beside the spring's course, dipped his hand, and drank. The cold had shot my teeth in numbness, but when I raised my head, the trees were distinctly drawn, newly made, strokes of charcoal against the sun's unbearable brightness. Is this what my father had been looking for all those years before, when he had gone on his quest, denied his body its sustenance? To see things more clearly, he'd said, to see what must be done. All that he had taken with him on his journey had been pulled from that brook, filling enough jars to keep him alive for 40 days and 40 nights, until his blood ran pure as the snow-chilled water. I remembered on one of our last hunts together how my father had led my brother Greg and me into the forest, marched us for hours along skitter trails, across the ridges and down the draws of the country he had logged for cedar. I'd been pleased to be in his company, believing we were making headway, working toward common ground. I meant to prove to him my stamina, demonstrate the accuracy of my eye. What came instead was the moment he had planned all along. Greg and I had not been paying attention, he said, had been depending on him for our sense of direction. There was a lesson we must learn. Now, he said, pointing at me, you will lead us out. How could I? Walking the long miles in, I had noted only the lean of his back, the easy gait that carried him effortlessly over logs and through the thick buckbrush and vine maple. I had not marked the dog-legged red fur, slashed a bee in the bark of pine, bled the carmine vein of wild plum. Clouds melted the sky to metal. There was no sun to guide my way. We wandered for miles, my father pretending the role of meek and willing follower, while all the time I inwardly raged. Finally, as the pewter sky darkened to lead, I turned to him in defeat. I don't know where we are, I said, I don't know which direction is right. He'd only nodded, moved toward a log where we might all rest. You look down too much, he said. You haven't been watching. He pointed the ember of his cigarette toward the horizon. You've got to see it all, forward, backward, sides. You get lost in here, it'll be a long time before someone finds you. I'd lowered my eyes, ashamed, fearful that he might see what I was thinking. You could. You could find me. You won't always have the sun or even stars. You have to make your own map. Memorize. He rose, stretched the stiffness from his back. Now he said, let's go home. And we followed him, my brother and I, feeling his largeness before us, knowing we'd been lost and then found, each of us full of anger and gratitude, love and hate, and an awareness that wherever we walked in the world, we would carry this truth within us. I lay in my bed and heard my father's voice and the voices of others come back to me. The same voices that had promised consequence and retribution, that had prophesied my harvest of pain. What the voices offered now was not condemnation, but the harsh encouragement that was also my legacy. The rough prod that had boosted me up on the playground when the bully knocked me down, that had made me despise self-pity and believe that I could withstand anything with the sheer will of my body and mind. There was some of this yet in me, composed of a faith I could not unlearn and a peevish belief in my own survival, and something else, my inherent willingness to disobey. I had suffered the consequences of disaffirming the authority of the church and my father. I had been shunned and shamed, prayed for and denounced. Always, I believed, I could survive. That one fragment of will I had kept hidden from David came back into me, lodged itself in my breast. I saw clearly that things could not continue this way, but I had little sense of how they might change. Before, my boyfriends and I had broken up, given back class rings and sobbed our regrets for a night or two. But I knew I could not simply walk away from this. All I knew to do was confront, and that is what I planned, knowing that even as I rose from my bed and began gathering my clothes, I was risking something I could not name but recognize. The rage held deep, boiling, boiling. I did not doubt that I could run from David. I did not doubt he would find me. It was dark when I left the apartment. I breathed in the crisp evening air as I slid behind the steering wheel of my Capri and coaxed the engine to turn over. I'd driven little in the last several months, always a passenger beside David. The car itself had fallen into disrepair. I pumped the gas pedal, worked the clutch, then remembered the linkage was broken, and I had no reverse, only first gear. Straight forward then, across the lawn and onto pavement, 10 miles an hour, the small car screaming its resistance. I'd already called my cousin Les and her husband Mark, asked if I could borrow their Mustang to get me where I needed to go. It wasn't until I got to Les and Mark's house that I realized the time. After midnight, and Mark had to rise for work by 5, he came into the kitchen, shirtless and barefoot, listened as I explained my intent to find David, force him to face me. Are you sure you want to do this? Mark asked. I'm not certain how much he knew of the truth of my relationship with David, perhaps only enough to understand the danger. Do you want me to go with you? I should have a man with me. I could see that was what he was thinking. No, I said. Thanks. I wasn't sure what I was doing or why I was doing it, but I knew I wanted to do it alone. They watched me pull away, standing on the porch and waving goodbye like worried parents. I turned on the Thane Road, swung east. In my mind, there was a map I would follow, a logical progression from one point to another. I drove by his mother's house first, looking for his pickup, then headed toward downtown, cruising parking lots along the way, the Strike and Spare, the Sidetrack, the Arbor, the Bull Room, where I had once drunk every last drop of rum the bartender could pour, then down Normal Hill to Modern West, with its enormous dance floor and fancy booted cowboys who knew how to put a shine on the two-step. I searched the littered alleys behind Curly's and Effie's and the Silver Dollar. I turned on the radio, then clicked it off, distracted by the music. I wanted nothing to interfere with what might lead me, what sounds I might catch coming in from the night. I rummaged the ashtray for anything worth smoking, lit the stub of a Winston, and kept driving. Smitty's Barrel, their Litton House, the Jade Lantern. The Red Shield was the last chance for liquor if you were headed west out of town, and it was there I found David's pickup. I threw the Mustang into park and nearly ran before catching myself. I had to remain calm. I entered the restaurant through which he'd walked to get from the bar to the parking lot. I was shaking and winded as I moved to the counter. People turned to look, then slid their eyes away. I didn't care that my hair and clothes were mussed, that I'd forgotten to put on lipstick. The waitress kept her eyes lowered, busying herself with my flatware and water. I ordered a ham and cheese sandwich, suddenly ravenous for food. She didn't ask me if I wanted a drink, but simply nodded when I ordered a double gin and tonic. It would be a lie to say I wasn't afraid, because I was afraid in an excited, fatal way. My choices were to run or to stay and fight, and the impulse to face my enemy made my pulse race. In the mirror behind the counter, my eyes reflected back deep blue, my pupils dark. I felt the gin hit hard and welcome. My plate was in front of me when David came out of the bar and into the bright light of the restaurant. Another woman was with him. He saw me immediately and stiffened, then told her to wait outside. We were two patrons at the counter then, David and I, a tall, painfully thin man with wild hair, towering over a young woman who looked as though she, too, might be crazy. The air around us must have filled with the animal smells of fear and rage, for he was angered beyond words by my disobedience. It was the first time I had seen in him such loss of control, the only time I had seen any outward show of passionate emotion, and this strengthened my courage, for some part of the sterile mechanism that drove him had broken down. "You don't want to do this," he said. "You don't want to make me mad. You wanted to hurt me, and if it had not been for the place of our confrontation, well-lit, peopled by potential witnesses, my escape may not have been so easy." I absorbed David's anger, met his eyes, and would not look away. "You mess with me, Kim, and you'll regret it. You don't want to know what I will do to you." I was beyond that now, beyond caring. Others were watching us, and I saw the burly cook come from his kitchen, wiping grease on his white apron. David saw him too, and backed slowly away from me, never taking his eyes off mine until he reached the door, which swung shut behind him in a rush of cold air. "Yes," I assured the cook, "I was fine." "No, the man was not bothered." I pushed back the sandwich I hadn't touched, drank what was left of my gin. The waitress slipped the tab into her pocket. I nodded my thanks, turned, and walked out. I knew David was already gone, and maybe I knew it meant nothing. Back in the apartment, I emptied his clothes into grocery sacks, threw his belongings out on the porch, the last thing, the great horned owl, which came down heavy in my arms and smelled of dust. I clipped my fingernails against its glass eyes, felt the dry roughness of its beak, imagined its push from my arms where it came when it came to lie, take flight, disappear from the lights of the city. I stroked its cool back, felt the dry quills beneath the satin feathers. I held it for a moment, then leaned it against the outside wall of my apartment, where it sat like a gargoyle, guardian between two worlds. I thought I knew the dangers of opposing David. I believed I could bear the consequences. When he threatened me at the bar, I felt even stronger, more determined, and I knew that this is what I must do. I called his mother, said that he should come and get what was his. The next day, I watched as he carried the boxes and bags to his pickup. I didn't flinch, didn't offer a word of apology or regret. He came out of the bedroom with my shotgun, said he'd take it for what money I owed him, the rent, the food. He left me with less than he found me with, and that seemed right. Why then, having made such a clean break, did I call him the next week, agree that he could come over for dinner? I know I was crazy with loneliness, but that is not enough to explain the risk I was taking. I can almost believe that I knew what it was, why it was I who must initiate some final scene, because he was not finished with me. I wanted control, owning what I could of time and place. If I called him to me, he could not take me by surprise. Or was there part of him, part of who I was with him, that I could not let go of? Something more than simple dependence, something less than love, a last fix of the intoxicating rush of the forbidden he had introduced me to, a goodbye kiss to my bittersweet shadow. I cannot cheat here. I do not mean to be coy. Let me play it like a movie then, because that's how it exists for me. A reel that can be run forward and back and wraps around on itself and begins and ends and begins again. A man comes to the door and the woman lets him in. They talk a few cool words, then she rises to make dinner. They sit together on a worn green sofa, plates of venison and potatoes balanced on their knees. Watch TV. We cannot hear the television or what few words pass between them. The woman drinks a single glass of the wine he has brought, but it goes to her head in a way she will remember later as odd, making her feel less drunk than pleasurably sleepy, a little giddy, high, really. The world seems a good place. He draws her to the carpeted floor and dresses her, ties her wrists and ankles, gags her with a scarf. He takes pictures with a Polaroid he has brought in a bag. He hurts her then in ways he has not done before, and the pain and fear cut through the feeling she has had of floating, being coddled. She quits biting the ties that cross over her back and between her breasts because she knows how they are made to tighten this way. She tries to scream, whether out of fear that a neighbor might hear or compassion she would never assume. He pauses, lifts her to the couch, unties her, takes the cloth from her mouth, but then he hurts her again. She cannot cry. She's tired, so tired. He covers her with a blanket, wraps it behind her back. He's done with her now, she thinks. Now she can sleep. But then he lifts her and moves toward the door. Where are you taking me? She asks. There are others, he says, waiting. Others want to have her. he will take her to them. No. He hesitates in the doorway. There, between the cold night and the warm room, she says it again. No. She says, I will scream. She says this without looking at him because she cannot open her eyes or raise her head because she is so tired. She cannot be afraid because there is no fear left in her. He stands in the doorway for a long time, it seems, holding her like a child, one arm beneath her shoulders, one arm beneath her knees. She rests, given over now to what must happen next. And when he turns and steps back into the room, she is not surprised, but indifferent. He lays her on the couch. He kneels down beside her, strokes her hair. And then he tells her, makes this promise. Just as he has done with other lovers, he will someday come back for her. Years from now, when she has nearly forgotten, when she is alone and the world sleeps deftly on, he will find her. He leaves, closes the door behind him with a hush. She is asleep before the noise of his engine can reach her, and she does not hear him pull away. The woman who, as a child, could numb herself to the belt finds that she can once again shed her skin and slip away, untethered, untouched, dreaming of nothing. Gone, gone, gone to the nothing song of air. Thank you.